Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Journey to Success Radio Network. Our purpose on Journey to Success Radio is to interview people who are making a difference in the world with their transformational thoughts, ideas, and actions. We'll explore important aspects and areas of life, including physical, spiritual, mental, relationships, business, sales, and much, much more. The Journey to Success broadcast team consists of Michael Collins, who's the author of Ushering in the Golden Age and a soon-to-be Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor. Taylor Tagg, he's the author of Enrich Your Sunrise, also a soon-to-be Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor. And Tracy Montgomery, she's a fellow Canadian in Calgary, Alberta. She publishes ebooks on dating and marriage, and they've been downloaded close to 20,000 times. As well as myself, Tom Tuttle Cunningham. I'm a Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor, also a regular contributor to their weekly e-zine, and I'll also be speaking at the 2012 Napoleon Hill International Convention in Malaysia. That's next month. Deepak Chopra is the keynote speaker for that event. I've had rheumatoid arthritis since the age of 5. That's 43 years now, and I've had 4 hips, 4 knees, and 2 shoulders replaced, and been in hospital about 40 times. When I told Nigel that, he said I sounded like a spider. I'm also a senior research director for the Canadian Business Journal, which is a digital-only publication. That's the official and only media partner with the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. You can find out more about me at my website. That's Tom, the number 2, and Tall, T-A-L-L.com. Today, we're excited and honored to have Nigel Wall join us all the way from Trinidad. Nigel was born in England in 1955, and he pursued a career in engineering, following his father into British aerospace and qualifying as a design engineer in late 1981. He then moved on into nuclear engineering, and he found himself more interested in the computer and software applications than the job itself. He moved then into the booming IT sector and spent the next 20 years in a number of companies ranging from pre-IPO startups to blue-chip companies like GE and IBM, and in roles from technical specialists to sales and business management. In 2001, he made a life-changing decision to get out of the IT sector and start his own business in the area of leadership development and coaching. And the rest, they say, is history. Nigel is now a recognized leader in his field. He's had numerous articles in print and a major book, Ask Leadership. He has coached at all levels in companies ranging from small and medium-sized enterprises right up to major Fortune 500 companies. And his experience has taken him from working with frontline supervisors to the most experienced CEOs in over 10 different countries. His clients over his busy career to date include companies like Bank of America, BP, Philips, Fujitsu, FedEx, BHP, Billiton, as well as many small and medium-sized companies. In addition to coaching and facilitating personal and organization development programs, he has also developed a considerable reputation as a powerful motivational speaker, working with professionals and companies and athletes. And he is as happy with a group of 3 or 4 people as he is on stage with 3 or 4,000 people delivering his electrifying presentations. He is very driven and goal-oriented, and he consequently has had a very busy life as founder and president of Ask Leadership Limited, and as an ultra-marathon runner and multi-sport athlete. Nigel, welcome to the show today.
Hey, thank you very much, Tom. It's great to be here. Great to be here.
It's, I think, the first overseas interview I've done, so kind of neat for me as well. And Nigel, I understand from our emails before the show that a little bit like my favorite speaker of all time, Zig Ziglar, you have a little bit of a similarity there. Zig did not become the speaker and motivator that the world knows him as until his early 40s. He ranged around in a number of businesses before that. And your story is a little bit similar to that, isn't it? Tell me about the event that caused you to turn your whole life around when you turned 40 because you were not always the Nigel Wall that I just described, were you?
No, that's true, Tom. It really started on a visit to a doctor. I think I just not long past 40. It was an insurance assessment, and the doctor I knew reasonably well, and he kind of did all the tests, and he tutted a bit and made a few comments, and I said, "So, everything okay?" And he said, "Well," he said, "I'm going to sign the form this time, but," he said, "it may not be, it may be the last time I have to go through this." And I was like puzzled, and I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, you know, your blood pressure's high, your lungs rattle because you're smoking too much, you're probably 50 pounds overweight, this is a critical time in life, and, you know," he said, "to be honest, if you don't change something, you're going to struggle to make 50. I was pretty shocked and horrified at that, and he said, "You know, what do you want to see your future for your girl?" Because I had two daughters. I have two daughters, but then they were aged 10 and 13. And I said, "Well, you know, I want to see him graduate through college and, you know, eventually maybe get married, walk them down the aisle and so on." And he said, "You're going to have to change some things." So I walked out of the surgery pretty shocked.
Yeah.
I was about to light up a cigarette because I was stressed. instead of doing that, I screwed the pack up and threw it in the garbage. And
wow.
I declared myself, amongst many things, a non-smoker.
Wow. And now a lot of people have the same talk with their doctor, and, you know, close to 40, around 40. But not everyone goes about making that major change and shift in life that their doctor, sometimes their family, sometimes their wife recommends. How did you go from hearing what the doctor said to making those drastic changes, not just with smoking, but, you know, you went from being that and overweight to now an ultra marathoner. So how did you make that switch in your not only your thoughts and decisions, but your actions as well?
Well, it was, I'd been uneasy about things for a while, so I think that had been a challenge. I always declared myself, and I actually use that when I'm coaching people today. I say to people, "I'm an expert in giving up smoking because I did it 10 times. in the years before I gave up for good, I gave up smoking many times, and of course I always regressed, and it was because, you know, smoking for somebody else. So I was giving up smoking for, perhaps my wife was nagging me. It was like the government then put tax on cigarettes at a higher level. They banned smoking at work. So it was always somebody else's reasons. When I got that message from the doctor, I really took it to heart, and I realized that the first thing, giving up smoking, was now for me and my future and my family, not because the doctor told me or somebody else told me. So it was the easiest thing I've ever done. I then declared to myself, I'd been a goal setter, but I hadn't done much writing down, but I declared to myself, and I wrote down these words. I haven't got the piece of paper, but it was very ragged, and I carried around for a while. And I said, I will be fitter on my 50th birthday than I ever have been in my life.
Whoa.
Yeah, pretty spooky, because in my early days I had been pretty fit, but I made this declaration, and the next day, in the evening after I got in from work, it was a very, very stressful job as well, I decided I'll go for a run. And I made it about 250, 300 yards before I was sick. I actually threw up. So I thought maybe going straight from, you know, a few years of immobility to running was not that clever. So I set myself a six-month goal, to run a half marathon, which is 13.1 miles. And I simply started by walking, and I would walk a half a mile, then the next day I would walk a mile. And then over time I found it was actually working. And before I knew it, 6 months had gone past. I'd lost probably 40 pounds.
Wow.
And I ran a half marathon, and I did my second best time ever. I did 1 hour, 52 minutes.
Holy smoke. On your first one?
Yeah. My first one. Most people were talking about, you know, get inside 2.5 hours, Nigel, and you know, at your age you'll be cool. But I was extremely, extremely determined. So that kicked off the whole personal transformation process, although I didn't know what it was called at the time. I kind of I just started setting goals in lots of other areas and also drew up a list of stuff I'd done before. So I ended up with my kind of focus being very much on this determination to live 10 years, but do it in style, do it in real style.
Nice. Style is good. Jim Rohn was, yeah. I think, one who talked about that, you know, do it in style.
Yes. Again, I wasn't very well read on kind of leadership and attitude and motivational people, but it seems that I was doing most of the right things.
Exactly. Now, Nigel, I'm a big fan, and as are you, of the late Charlie Tremendous Jones, and I love his daughter Tracy Jones, the president of Tremendous Life Books. And Charlie is famous for his saying that you'll be the same person in 5 years that you are today, except for the books you read and the people you meet. And I agree 100% with that. What are two or three books that you've read since that 40th birthday that have really impacted your thinking and your actions and what you do in life?
Okay. Yeah, I'm a great fan of Charlie Tremendous Jones' books and so on. I check him out on YouTube every now and then, because of course I never met him, but I know Tracy as well. Just before I tell you about the books, my favorite quote of his that I use when I'm getting people to build their own attitude is this famous thing where he says, hang around thinkers, you'll be a better thinker. Hang around achievers, you'll be a better achiever. Hang around givers, and you'll be a better giver. Hang around a bunch of thumb-sucking, complaining, griping boneheads, and you'll be a better thumb-sucking, complaining, griping bonehead.
He really had a way to lay it out there, didn't he?
He just said it as it was. There's no pussyfooting around with Charlie. It's just like in your face. And I think I probably learned a little bit of his style. When I'm on stage, particularly with large groups, I don't hold pull back punches. And if I need a little bit of my subtlety removed, I go watch a Charlie Jones video on YouTube. So back to the book. I digress, as I'm sure I will frequently during our conversation. I think one of the early authors that I started to read, actually it wasn't so much his books, it was his programs, and this was Paul J. Meyer. I'd seen things about Paul, and eventually ended up doing the Effective Personal Leadership Program. And eventually I actually signed up as a licensee of the Leadership Management International and facilitated his programs for 7 or 8 years. And that's what got me started in the business. But I love the Effective Personal Leadership, this whole thing about thinking big, dreaming big, setting goals, having clear written goals, building your attitude and the attitude you need to succeed. Mm-hmm. You know, that building that fire in the belly and so on. So I have a lot to thank Paul for in terms of his motivation. Right. I also always, right from the One Minute Manager, have been a great fan of Ken Blanchard and his various co-writers. He produces such meaningful stories that put into context what personal leadership and people leadership is about, and he simplifies it to a level that I just find it very easy to interpret. And again, I use a lot of his stuff when I'm facilitating. So I've been very well, highly influenced by Ken Blanchard. If I look around at my book racks, I'm in my office, I've probably 5 of my top row of books are Ken Blanchard books. And of course, leading at a higher level, which brings up the whole thing around servant leadership, is probably one of my favorites.
Yes.
And then more recently, I've got really hooked on Robin Sharma and his writing. I picked up and read The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari quite a few years ago, and that was in my mid-40s when I was going through. I mean, I didn't have a Ferrari, but I was certainly in the position of that attorney in there who was working too many hours, who was stressed, who was slowly killing themselves through their job. And so you reinvent yourself, and that certainly helped me back then. I then kind of lost touch with Sharma, and then he came to Trinidad, and he came to the Hilton, at the Hilton Hotel, and he did a presentation to 500-600 people, and I was invited to kind of be the warm-up act. So not only did I get to share a stage with Robin Sharma, who had become something of my hero, but I got to spend some time with him.
Wow, that's amazing. And he's a Canadian as well.
Right, very, 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 very smart guy, and particularly his book, The Leader Who Had No Title, which I would recommend to anybody who's looking at building their personal leadership strengths and getting more out of themselves as individuals. It's more about leading yourself than it is leading other people. It's a powerful, powerful book. I've got an awful lot out of that. So I would recommend that to anybody.
And I love Paul J. Meyer. What a great man he was as well.
Yes, indeed. And sadly missed, unfortunately, because as you all know, he passed away a couple of years ago, but very powerful, very, very powerful guy. The last book, because I thought about that when you were talking about the book, and you know, I think leadership books, but then I go back to my 30s probably, and there's a book called Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Oh, yeah, great book.
By Richard Beck. It may seem odd, but, you know, the first part of the book is really all about exploring the limits of what you can and can't do in the guise of an adventurous seagull. And when I think back to and reflect on when I read that book, there was a little bit of that in me at the time. I think it just exploded out in my 40s and drove me forward. Yeah.
That was a great selling book, a really amazing book. I read it when I was young, and it was a real bestseller at the time when it came out, wasn't it?
It was. I think it sold 30 million. It was on the top of the bestsellers book list for almost a year, you know, the book list.
And in many companies, or in many countries as well, not just North America.
Yeah, sure.
Tremendous, tremendous. Now, tell me, first of all, I'm very impressed that Paul Meyer wrote a foreword for the book. Like yourself, you had mentioned, I think, a leadership course you took. The very first personal development course I ever paid for was, it was SMA. Was that what it was called? Success Management something or other?
I think it was SMI, Success Motivation, Inc.
There you go, Success Motivation, and I took a goal-setting course given by a SMI franchisee here in Canada, and ever since then I was very, very impressed with Paul, and also a great man in that he gave away a lot of money. He was a very generous man, very, very tremendous person, other than just being a great trainer and teacher as well. Tell me about some of the major ideas in your book, Ask Leadership. For Paul Meyer to write such an amazing foreword to the book, I want our listeners to find out some of the main ideas behind that book.
Sure. Well, I've been facilitating Paul's programs at the time, the LMI programs, because after SMI, well, he went on to found Leadership Management International, and I was facilitating some of his programs. And I was working with one-on-one with a CEO of a local finance organization, and he'd got a very autocratic style. He's actually Indian in origin, so he was born in India and then came over here to Trinidad. And it was causing a few challenges with his people. A very, very smart guy, don't get me wrong, but a little kind of autocratic. So I was coaching him on questioning and engaging his people to bring out the best in them so that they made decisions, they became empowered, everybody recognized that an honest mistake was something to be coached around and even celebrated at times rather than castigated and pushed down. So we were working on that. And he said to me, Nigel, can you do some research for me and find me a reference book? Because I can't carry you around with me on aeroplanes and whatever. So I went on Amazon, and I went to local bookstores, and I went to Barnes & Noble, and I went all around the place, and I couldn't find a good book on how to become a coaching leader. So I explained this to him when I met him the next week, and he said, well, Nigel, you've got that on your list, because we always talked about my list. You've got write the best-selling leadership book on your list, haven't you? And I said, yeah. He said, well, there's your opportunity. Go write the book. So he edged me into that, and so it was actually a very easy process for me to write the book because I'd got it all in my head. The best leaders are the best coaches, and so the question is, how do you do it? It's all really saying, you know, coach your people, but of course, well, here I am sitting with somebody who's not performing very well. How do I turn that into a coaching exercise? How do I use my coaching skills to empower and delegate? How do I use my coaching skills to give feedback and so on? So The book really it investigates, well, first of all, there's a couple of assessments up front which help you understand what your natural style is. So there's an exercise called boss versus leader. So you can measure your own score to say, well, am I a boss, which is the autocratic style, or am I a leader, which is the empowering and engaging style? So you make the assessment. There's an assessment on what's your communication style, you know, whether you're expressive, amiable, analytical, or driver. And then it goes to a whole range of different case studies targeted against specific leadership areas with poor leadership style, good leadership style. And from the case studies, I encourage people to actually pick and choose conversations that they read in the case studies and apply them in real life. So it's not simply about getting more knowledge. It's about the practical application of it.
Yes.
And when I sent... When I sent the script via my publisher, who actually was is a part of the Paul J. Meyer Enterprise Group, Leading Edge Publishing, Brian Mast, and I still keep saying thanks to Brian Mast for helping me do that. So he's now taken me on the book production road.
Wow.
Yeah, I knew that Paul would like it. I knew he'd get it, but I thought, how do I engage somebody who presumably gets lots of manuscripts? I'd met him a few times, I'd seen his presentations, but he didn't really know me.
Right.
He probably knew of me. So I told him about my goals list, because I know what a passionate man he is about goals.
Mm-hmm.
I told him about my goals list, and I sent him the manuscript, and on the first page of the goals list, and I asked him to review it, and then, would he kindly write a foreword? And the rest, as they say, he just... according to his staff, he was excited about it. He read it and then, you know, wrote the foreword for me. So it was about how do I practically apply something as opposed to simply becoming more knowledgeable.
Yes, that's what I noticed about your book, is that unlike other books that you would read and be like, "Ooh, that was really good information," yours, among all the most of the leadership books I've read, have a lot of exercises. You put people through some real thinking and processes to, as you said, figure out what type of leadership style they have, and then, as you said, with the case studies, analyze them and using your style, you know, how best to deal with it. And so I found that, as you said, it's not just, oh, wow, Nigel's a great writer. It's like, oh, man, a lot of work. But if you want to be a good leader, you can't just read a book and say, I'm a great leader now.
Took another book off the list.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and go on, Tom.
No, I was going to say, and so, you know, that's what I noticed about the book. It really will help you, take you through a process to discover what works best for you and how to apply it in many different situations.
Yeah, and there are many, I use it as a tool when I'm facilitating now, particularly on leadership work. So as we go through the 5 or 6 meetings, you know, 2-3 hour meetings, I actually use it as a tool. But you can just pick it up off the shelf, or you can go to Amazon.com and you'll find it up there, and work your way through it yourself, or work your way through it with groups of individuals within your company. So you can kind of self-facilitate around it. But it's been very effective, and I thank Paul for his support, and I'm sure somewhere up there he's looking down and smiling.
Now, tell me about your decision to leave corporate life and to become a coach and help develop people. Lots of people probably in corporate life have had this thought before, but not everyone has done something about it. Now, when you did that, were you able to have immediate success, replace your income in like a month, or were there some bumps in the road and some fear and trepidation about leaving good corporate positions to be on your own?
I can the old kind of sweats that I would get into on occasions when I waved goodbye to that last paycheck, but I was never sorry about it. And I had a plan, and my plan was very simple, that within 12 months I would be earning the equivalent of my last paycheck from corporate.
Very good.
So, again, it's down to this absolute dedicated focus on goal setting and then doing the actions around it to make the goal come true. And it is really as simple as that. So I had a plan. I went out and I spent 6 months. I didn't really earn very much, but that was not my goal. My goal was to learn how to do a good job and how to give value to my clients. So I hung around with other coaches and other people who kindly invited me to come to their sessions to learn the art of facilitation, which I now know is an absolute imperative skill for anybody who's coaching. You have to learn to be a great facilitator, not a great teacher. So I learned the art of facilitation and then used materials to bring that to life. So, yeah, I had some disappointments, but I'd already learned that every failure would put a smile on my face and go, well, I'm not going to do that again. Whenever I thought of that, I would think back to Paul's favorite, one of his stick-to-it-ness comments about when he was an insurance agent in his early 20s. Not many people know Paul was the youngest member of the Million Dollar Round Table. Which is the insurance company's Oscar award. He still is to this day. He is, at the age of 22, he's the youngest MDRT member, and his name is still on the record book. And when he talks about every door he knocked on, because in those days of insurance sales in the 50s, you walked up and down streets in your neighborhood. And he used to say, I'd knock on 50 doors in a day, and I would get 48 slammed in my face. And he said, the next day, I would get 46 slammed in my face. And the next day, 45 slammed in my face. Until what I realized was, more than half of the people who I had conversations with were inviting me into their home. And of those people, half of them were buying policies from me. And within 7 or 8 months of him starting in the business, he was the top producer in his branch. And it just kept reminding me, more doors slamming in your face, more people saying, I'd love to do business with Nigel, but you don't have enough experience. I'd love to do business with you, Nigel, but, you know, whatever. I just smiled at those because I'd learned what to do differently next. If there are entrepreneurs listening to this and people who are starting out in a new field, is the stick-to-it attitude is the thing that's going to make the biggest difference. And yes, you can do other things. You can be run your business smarter. You can learn faster. You can be more target marketed and so on. But it's your inner attitude that's going to carry you through to that point.
Your persistence and your positive mental attitude, that's sometimes the only things you'll have going for you. And that's what you still have. That's when you have to press on.
It is. And I just finished my next book, which is completely different to the leadership book. It's a whole series of stories and things about, you know, how, you know, some guidelines as to how to kind of figure out how to be successful and so on. And the more I looked at successful people, the more I found this consistency. And I found it in three primary areas. One is people who succeed have clear written goals and plans, absolutely clear view of what they're going to do and how they're going to do it and why they're going to do it, their motivation. The second thing is they are intensely self-motivated and driven people. And the third thing is what you just talked about, Tom, which is they have a positive mental attitude. They don't just see their glass half full. They see it overflowing with opportunity. They take more risks. They kind of accept failure as a necessary mechanism and step towards the achievement of the ultimate goals and objectives.
Yes, exactly. And with those three things, you can accomplish anything, really.
You can take on the world. You can be, to quote Robin Sharma, you can be the best in the world at anything you really set your mind to.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, Nigel, tell me about, I want to find out a little bit about working in Trinidad. I have in Toronto here, very, very, probably one of the most multicultural areas in the world. We have tons of Trinidadian people. I've met a lot of them through church, and their culture may be different than a North American culture when you're coaching and training people. And also even in Europe, I think the culture might be different there as far as coaching skills and strategies for dealing with people in those different areas of the world. Tell me about working in Trinidad, as well as, you know, what are some of the culture and business differences between there and North America and Europe and other places where you've done some work.
Cool. Yeah. First of all, I absolutely love Trinidad and its people and the culture. And you're right, there are a lot of Trinis up in Toronto. I have a lot of friends here who pop up to Toronto because granny's there or sister's there or whatever.
Yeah.
but it's a wonderful, wonderful environment. It's a beautiful, well, the two islands, the twin island republic of Trinidad and Tobago. And I've done work in both. I've also worked in Barbados, Jamaica, and a couple of other islands. So the fundamentals, because they're people, is the fundamentals are the same for, you know, as here as they are in the US, as they are in the UK, and some areas in Europe. So the fundamental belief systems are the same. A lot of the motivation is the same.
Right.
Some of the leadership skills in some of the older, more traditional companies do err on the autocratic side, so there is naturally not as much empowerment as there may be in some North American companies, which is a great opportunity because the organizations are succeeding, but they're succeeding despite some of their behaviors.
Right, so, right. And when you say, I mean, when you say that, I think of when I mentioned to you earlier, what I was thinking of was that the Trinidadian people I met, I've heard of a term called island time. And so amazingly great people, so friendly and everything. But from a woman I dated, like, they are not on time for so many different things. And so different cultures, you know, in North America, like, everything's like to the minute. Yeah, everybody has a watch on and they work by their watch. And yet when I people I've met from Trinidad, they're more laid back and time isn't so pressing for them.
That's absolutely correct. There's two aspects to that culture, Tom. One is the in-work, in-business attitude, and the other one is the out-of-work environment. I think what Trinidadian businesses are realizing, and of course a lot of multinationals here now, the GDP of this country is very dependent on oil and gas. So people like BP, BG, Australian company, BHP, Billiton, are here. And they accept they're in an island culture, but boy, when a meeting is scheduled to start at 8 o'clock in the morning, you are sitting ready at 7 to 8 in the morning. So they've managed a little bit by hiring, but mostly by making the culture, you know, the culture of the organization is the international culture. But you
right.
know, on a Friday night when people leave, we have this term here called liming.
Oh, yes, I'm familiar.
Yeah, right. So in the UK, it might be chilling. It might be, you know, going out to party, whatever. Trinidadians and Tobagonians, we lime, which means
yes.
we hang around in bars.
Knockabout. I've heard the phrase knockabout as
knock
well.
Knockabout. So the real big culture thing is liming. Trinidadians are very, very friendly people. And
yes.
you can walk on a beach, sit near some people, and if they've got a cooler with some beers in it, you'll probably end up with a beer from their cooler. You'll end up chatting with them and so on. So
everyone's their friend.
That's it. So they're truly great people, very friendly. The most friendly environment I've ever lived and worked in, which is probably why, you know, I don't have any plans on leaving here. I like the work, the business side of things, and I love the liming and the kind of chill nature. But I think some of the organizations thrive despite the behaviors of the leaders and internally. So the great opportunity for them is when they start to adapt, which I spend time with other local facilitators, when they do adapt to more modern style, they find that it increases productivity of the people, they get
yes.
more ideas because they're engaging their people, their people are more likely to stay, they don't want to leave because it's a nice environment to work in,
so
invariably the organization benefits, and because it's already working well,
yes.
they can easily move from, you know, feel good to great thing.
Exactly.
There's some very, very good businesses, yeah.
And yet they can get that international culture, and yet at the same time, the Trinidadian people are not going to change. So when their time for liming is there, they'll be right in there. Although if they tell you to meet you at 8 o'clock at the bar, that just means sometime this evening, not necessarily 8 o'clock.
Exactly. And we've got the other great part of Trinidad and Tobago culture here, which is carnival starts in a couple of weeks.
Carnival is the
big street party. I guess you have a Toronto carnival, don't you?
We have an amazing one in Toronto, very, very highly attended, and the city is a great party that weekend when we have it in summertime here. Now, Nigel, you'd sent me as well before, and we have, maybe 7 or 8 minutes left. Tell me about your goals list. Nigel's, you call it your JG list, is it?
Yeah, it is. I don't know whether any of your listeners have heard of a guy called John Goddard, but if you haven't, go take a look at his webpage. I just searched for him on Google and look for John Goddard and Life List.
Okay. Yes, I've heard of him.
I was inspired in one of Paul Mayer's pieces to go and read Goddard. I had a list of goals which I'd worked on and which I was working on, but I thought I'd go take a look at this guy, John Goddard, and see what I could learn from him. And what I found was he set himself a list when he was 15 in 1940. He sat down and wrote a list of 127 things he wanted to do in the rest of his life, which is a very bold move for a teenager.
Yeah.
But he did that. He came up with this list of 127 things. And interestingly, some of them were relatively trivial. He would hold his breath underwater for 2 minutes, run a 5-minute mile, which for a 15-year-old is probably not that difficult.
Right.
Some, frankly, outstanding things like navigate every river over 1,000 miles long, climb every mountain over 18,000 feet, take off an aircraft carrier. All the listeners, go take a look at that list, 127 things.
Wow.
The last time I looked at it, he'd achieved 109 of them.
Wow.
It's awesome, awesome. And if you bear in mind, the guy is 80-something years old now. As of the middle of last year, I'm pretty sure he's still around. I'll be surprised if he isn't, because I think there would have been some announcements. But I was interested in this, and I looked at my list, and I suddenly realized I got a list. Not only had I got a list, but it had some pretty big things on it. But looking at some of John's, I thought, I can do more than this. I can do bigger than this. So I started to rework the list and add things to it and big things up a bit. My list, I think, I'm not sure the one I sent you, but I'm at 100 things on the list. I think I've done all but 23 of them, so I'm at 75% or something. And actually, my list, John's list was static. My list was dynamic, so I change and mess with it. I don't change many things, but I add things to it.
But you're going to have to add things.
Yeah, because eventually you run out of stuff to do.
Yes.
John's got a couple on his list that he said he was not going to attempt. One was to appear in a Tarzan movie. he also recognized that with time, some things look a little silly. The other...
Yes.
Was to go to the moon. Now, he wrote this when he was 15, okay, in 1940.
Yeah.
And it looks like he's going to miss out, because Virgin are only just got their galactic transport, and I don't think at 80-something years old they're probably going to let him onto that to go to the moon. But you see the level of ambition John had. And I wanted to learn more from John. So I eventually, by messing around on the internet, I found his phone number. This is at the end of 2010. So I called him. And he said, "Hi, this is John Goddard." And I said, "Hi, John, this is Nigel." And we had a conversation. And I was just frankly amazed. I was speaking to one of my heroes. And I asked him a question. I said, "So of your 127 goals, what has it taken you to get there? How many goals?" Because you all know that if you're going to go climb Mount Everest, you need 5 or 6 goals to get you there. I call them elephant goals. So he came back and said, probably 700 or 800 goals, because he has lists still of goals that he works on at 80-something. And halfway through, well, I can't say halfway through the conversation, he said to me, Nigel, I just realized, I looked at my clock, I've got to go. And I said, that's great, John, but just tell me, where are you going? I expect him to say for a pizza or something like that. He said, he lives in San Diego now. He said, I'm just packing because I'm going to Bolivia to visit a tribe that I visited 30 years ago, and they've invited me back to see the progress they've made. So I
wow.
something years old, another goal checked off his list.
Oh, wow.
So my list.
He's probably going to live another 20 years because he has another 19 things to do.
He is so busy that I don't think he has time to die. So maybe there's a lesson for us all there. But I have my list, and I really enjoy it. It does inspire people, which I'm thankful for, and I use it as part of my coaching, that if you've got a list of things you want to do, and you then start to plan the goals. And some stuff that's on my list that I've done, let me share a couple of things. Well, I'm a published author. Well, that was
yes.
on my list. I've got another book coming out, which is another goal on my list. You mentioned I do ultra stuff. I've now gone from throwing up after 350 yards running to my longest regular race distance is 56 miles.
Wow.
So I'll run 56 miles. My last time was 10 hours, 12 minutes. My fastest is 9 hours, 39 minutes. Those races I've done mostly in South Africa.
Wow.
So I have goals my last goal was I did a triathlon last year, and you might say, well, sprint triathlon, it's quite a short distance. What's the big thing about that? Well, in November 2010, November 2010, I couldn't swim.
Yes.
And so you have to go from not swimming to swimming half a mile in open water in the sea. So I was very proud of that one. And I'm going back to do another triathlon in May. And then my goals get bigger as I get older. So I go from a sprint triathlon, a full Olympic triathlon in May. And then in November 2013, I'm going to a place called Cozumel in Mexico to do a
yes.
race called the Ironman.
Oh, yes.
And
the
Ironman is 2.4-mile open-water swim, then a 112-mile bike ride, then a 26.2-mile marathon to run, all in one shot.
That is a heck of an accomplishment when you do that one.
Yeah. So people say to me, so Nigel, how come you're going out swimming most lunchtimes? I said, because I got a goal in November 2013 to do this 2.4-mile swim. And they said, but it's only February 2012. And I look them in the eye and I say, that's how you get to the really, really big goal, is you do stuff every day, every couple of days, that moves you in the direction of the end result.
Exactly.
And I think it gets people starting. They say, how do you write a book? And I say, it's easy. It was one page a day for 250 days.
Exactly. Something a little bit every day, some action every day, bring you closer and closer and closer and closer, and it keeps your focus on it as well.
It does. It means that it's always in your mind. And John said a few things about that. You know, I said to him, you know, how did he to this day, again, 80-something years old, he holds two world records. One is for the civilian who flew the highest in any aircraft, so for the civilian
wow.
pilot. And secondly, to fly the fastest as a civilian pilot. And nobody has beaten those records that he holds. And he said he used to go down to the airfield and scrabble
wow.
in gardens and stuff to earn the money to get an hour in an airplane, to get his pilot's
yeah.
license, because he had these massive goals that he achieved 20, 30 years later.
Amazing. Well, I think everyone should put together their own JG list, and it will add a lot of juice and excitement and passion to their life. Nigel, we just have a minute left, so I just wanted to take this time to thank you so, so much. People can find you at your website, right, which is Nigel, N-I-G-E-L, J-Wall, W-A-L-L.com, NigelJWall.com,
yep.
and definitely people should pick up your book, Ask Leadership. And what is the title of your new book, and when is it coming out?
It's probably going to be called, as my granny used to say, and then the subtitle is A Little Book of Life. It's based on those old granny-type sayings, when your granny looks you in the eye and says, you know, a stitch in time saves nine and stuff. And then
yeah.
the whole there's 20-odd stories in there which will help motivate people and get them moving along the road to success.
Amazing. Well, we look forward to that. Nigel, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate that. And I encourage our listeners to look you up online and purchase your book as well. Have a great day, Nigel.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Take care.